Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help members of the military and their families thrive in their civilian career. Today's episode number 308 with Mike Vigliola.
You know, I think executive presence is the ability to be confident in front of a group of people, to be able to deliver a message clearly and in a compelling manner, and to get other people to want to follow you. So if you look at the impact of those things together, you end up with an individual who knows what they want their audience to do and where their audience is coming from and where they need them to go. And then they believe in themselves and believe in the message along the way.
Today is a skills episode where we dig into a specific skill set that is likely to be highly relevant to all listeners. Mike is an expert corporate instructor on many topics, and in this episode, we delve into executive presence, what it is, why it is so important to the veteran community, and specific actions that they can take today to start to further build this important skill set. Mike also talks about his own career path, starting his own company, and how executive presence has played a role in his success. I really enjoyed my conversation with Mike. We're going to have a couple other members of his team come on the show to cover similar topics that can be valuable skills for listeners. As always, at beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything to discuss. You'll also find our new swag section where you can buy Beyond the Uniform hats, t-shirts, polo shirts, stickers, all sold at cost to military veterans. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Mike. Joining me today in Columbus, Ohio, my guest is Mike Vigliola. Mike, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
I wanted to give listeners an abbreviated bio. Mike is the managing director of Thought Leaders, a professional services firm that offers instruction, coaching, and consulting on the subjects of leadership, communication, strategy, and operations. He started out at West Point, after which he served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an armor officer. And his work since then has included McKinsey & Company, Capital One, Scotts, and others. He's published 3 books, all of which will be included in the show notes for this episode, and is an author at LinkedIn Learning, where you can, along with hundreds of thousands of people before you, watch his videos on a variety of professional topics. So maybe to start things off, Mike, you spent 5 years in the Army prior to transitioning. Could you walk us through your transition process and what that first job search was like?
Yeah, so I was really fortunate in that I got a letter in the mail from somebody at McKinsey, and they said, hey, we'd like to talk to you. At the time, I was teaching ROTC at Duke University. I was a captain at the time, and I remember I looked at the letter. I had never heard of McKinsey, and I literally said, oh, they seem reputable. And it was like, yeah, okay. And I called them back and actually entered their interviewing process. But the interesting military footnote there is the reason I got that letter recruiting me was there was a guy who was at McKinsey, who was another West Point grad, and he went through the register of graduates. And he found members from my class who were coming up on their 5-year commitment. And based on a few screening criteria, he sent letters to us saying, hey, I know you're about to get out of the Army, or you could get out of the Army, and maybe you should think about a career with us. The transition was really interesting, going from the military world to corporate and consulting. I think one of the biggest shifts was really just picking up the language. It is a completely foreign language when you go from talking about tanks and op wards to talking about discounted cash flows and building Excel models. It was just a completely different language. So for me, that was the hardest part of the transition, was picking that up. Fortunately, McKinsey had some really great introductory training that I went to. And then it was very much a learning culture. So there was training available all the time. There was a lot of on-the-job training, and you had great managers who were willing to sit you down and walk you through that stuff. So, you know, a few months in, it was like, all right, I kind of get this now. I understand the language, and I understand the approach that we use on an engagement.
Hmm. What led to the transition to Capital One and Scotts Miracle-Gro?
Yeah, so McKinsey, the consulting was great, but there's a piece of it that you kind of don't get as a consultant, which is the ability to execute your ideas. Mm-hmm. As a consultant, you just push the recommendation across the table and say, hey, here you go. Hope you do something with it. The move to Capital One, there were a lot of McKinsey folks who had gone to Capital One. I think there were about 20 or 25 when I ended up joining Cap One. And we had this little community that was recruiting people out of consulting and into Capital One. The transition from Cap One to Scott's was really about getting an ability to work at the corporate level. So that was, I think, the biggest challenge is to go from a day-to-day operational kind of role where, you know, there was still strategy involved, but going to the next level of real corporate strategy and mergers and acquisitions, that was really interesting to me in terms of making that jump.
Hmm. And from there, you made probably, it seems like externally, maybe the biggest jump. You went on to start your own company, Thought Leaders. Was there a moment that you kind of attribute this genesis to? And what was that like to leave three absolutely incredible organizations, but also a lot of security to go bet on yourself?
Yeah. You know, I actually started Thought Leaders after I left Capital One and before I joined Scott's. Mm-hmm. And the genesis of it actually went to my time at Capital One. So when I was at Cap One, I started teaching some of the methods that I learned as a consultant. So communications and problem solving, started teaching those other folks at Capital One, and it was really popular. A lot of people wanted the training. And when I left Cap One, I said, if that many people are demanding this kind of stuff, there must be a market for it. So I started Thought Leaders then. Then I took the job at Scott's because I had a mortgage, I have kids, and you know, that stuff's not cheap. So I was running Thought Leaders off the side of my desk while I was at Scott's. Then I kind of had that moment one day where I got the you know, the pay stub in the mail, and it was like 30 days and it was X dollars. And, you know, some of it was fun at that point, and some wasn't. Then I also on the same day got a payment from a Thought Leaders client for teaching a class, and it was one day and it was a lot of fun, and it was more money than I was making, you know, just in my corporate role. So I'm like, all right, it's time to go. I was lucky enough to land a consulting engagement after I left Scott's Miracle-Gro, and that consulting gig essentially paid the bills for a year. And during the time that I wasn't consulting, I was spending time building the business.
That's great. And I want to correct me if this doesn't resonate with you, but I love this sense that you were being pulled into starting this company. It wasn't, yeah. I think today there's a little bit of pressure of everyone should have their own business or their own video line or their own podcast or whatever else. And I love this sense that you were letting the demand pull you into the opportunity rather than trying to force something that might not have been there.
Yeah. I mean, the market will tell you if there's something there, you know, and that doesn't mean that there's not a place for new ideas and things that you can build and take to market. But I was kind of a little bit risk averse doing that. You know, when the kids are young, it's like, yeah, you got to make sure this works. You can't just walk away. So it was really reassuring for me when I had prospects and clients calling me up and saying, hey, we want this kind of training, and then pulling me in.
And for listeners, I want to spend the bulk of our time talking about executive presence and diving deeper in there. But the other thing I just wanted to make space for was to learn a little bit more about Thought Leaders' mission, what your impact is.
Yeah, we're a leadership development and training firm. The two things that I hold up as different about us is, one, all of my instructors are practitioners. We're all business people. So I don't have academics or career facilitators. We don't sit there and just talk about theory. What we teach is immediately applicable and relevant, and it's because we've done this stuff for a living. Then the second thing I hold up as different is everything we teach is immediately applicable and relevant. So we make sure that our clients get impact in terms of behavior change that starts the minute that people walk out of our classes. Mm. You know, we serve mostly large corporates. A lot of the names, if I rattle them off right now, you'd recognize. And we're very fortunate to have an amazing list of clients. And we teach about 25 programs now. So we cover leadership, executive presence, communications, strategic planning, decision making. I like to say we teach the things that everybody needs that nobody ever teaches you. And a lot of it you pick up on the job, or you don't get a tool or a framework to do it. And what we do is we give people those methodologies, and we really try and simplify them. So it's a 5-step process or a 7-step process, because the techniques we teach are hard to apply. They're simple to learn, but they're really hard to apply. So we try to keep them as simple as possible.
So maybe to just kind of pull on that thread, what would you define as executive presence?
You know, I think executive presence is the ability to be confident in front of a group of people, to be able to deliver a message clearly and in a compelling manner, and to get other people to want to follow you. So if you look at the impact of those things together, you end up with an individual who knows what they want their audience to do and where their audience is coming from and where they need them to go. And then they believe in themselves and believe in the message along the way. So it comes across as confident, but there's a balance with arrogance, right? It comes across as genuine because you know what you want your audience to believe and you help them get there. It's not browbeating folks. It's laying out that argument that gets them to say, wow, this is a really exciting and interesting idea.
Why should listeners, let's say they're transitioning veterans or maybe a military spouse or someone who's been out of the military for a couple of years, why is this important to them? Why should they care about this?
So I think it's one of those things where you know people who don't have it, right? Mm-hmm. And you see them and people kind of wonder about following their ideas and if they should, you know, buy into what they're doing. And I think that confidence or lack thereof can really show up. That then leads to, you know, people deciding whether they even want to hire you, or if you're running your own firm saying, hey, do I want to bring this person in? Are they competent and are they capable? I think having a focus on it and really understanding the elements of it is going to differentiate you in the marketplace. The nice thing is for folks who have served, you already have a lot of that stuff, right? I mean, you have that ingrained leadership. You've been in front of people. You've galvanized them to do really difficult things, like in some cases, ridiculously difficult things. You know, getting somebody else to like approve a purchase order is not too hard when you look at some of the stuff that, you know, folks who have been enlisted or officers in the service have gone through. And, you know, military spouses deal with the same stuff. You know, you look at the circles that they're operating in, they're working with a lot of senior people in social environments and volunteer environments. So a lot of those things just rub off from being around folks who have been in the military. So I think military folks do have a step up in that regard. Versus folks who are just entering the workforce, I think they don't always give themselves credit for it. And this goes back to my comment about the vocabulary. So when I moved into corporate, it was this totally different language. And look, I had been a tank platoon leader. I had been a captain in the Army. I had taught ROTC programs. And it's like, yeah, but I'm a little bit timid here. I don't know what a PO is, and I don't know what MPV is. And all of a sudden you sort of step back and you feel like, wow, I'm really out of my league here. What was interesting was when I'd start interacting with clients, the folks who were my peers would say, wow, you were like really comfortable in that meeting. I'm like, yeah. They're like, dude, that was like a vice president. I'm like, so? They're like, yeah, but like you talked to him, like, and you looked him in the eye. I'm like, uh-huh, okay. You know, and it's just this stuff that you take for granted because you learned it in the service. So I think the thing I'd emphasize for folks who are leaving the service or who are spouses and are transitioning to new roles is, look, you've got a much stronger platform to stand on than you might believe, and kind of learn how to play to that, and not in a manipulative way, but learn how to let that out. Learn how to let people see that confidence in you. The language will come, the frameworks will come. That stuff's easy to learn. The confidence stuff is actually much harder. So I'd rather have that than know the definition of MPV and ROI.
The phrase that came to mind for me, and I've been out for 10 years, so I'm not sure if this is still relevant, but they always talked about command presence and that ability to kind of fill a room. And what I'm hearing is similarities there. But I like that encouragement for listeners to realize, like, to give themselves a little bit more benefit of the doubt in the workplace and to realize they have a lot to offer and not to downplay or hide their accomplishments or who they are.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, again, it's that balance, right? Where some people in the corporate world can be intimidated by that. So you really got to understand the environment, be quiet for a little while, learn what's going on and what the culture is. But once you have a good feel for it, go ahead and step up and offer your perspectives, offer your opinion. People are going to follow. There's a reason that folks are in the service and gravitate to that environment. It's because they like leading others and they like being part of a team and understand how those things fit together.
Is this something, executive presence, is that something that can be cultivated and developed? And if so, like, what are steps that listeners could take to start to nourish that?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I have to say that because we teach it as a firm. So I got to believe that it's something that can be cultivated and learned along the way. I think in terms of nourishing it, the first thing you've got to understand is, what is your message and where do you want the audience to be at the end of your conversation? Whether it's talking to one person or 1,000, you need to understand, where are they starting and where do you want them to go? Because if you don't have either of those points, they're not going to follow you. And I don't care how much command presence and executive presence, if people don't know the why behind the recommendation, it's really hard to get them to move. So I think that's the first thing that you really got to cultivate, is knowing your audience, knowing your message, and knowing what it's going to take to get them to move. I think the second thing to really cultivate it is to play with different styles. A lot of folks have stereotypical views of what ex-military folks are like. And, you know, stereotypes exist for a reason. And it's because there's a lot of data out there. So you gotta be careful about playing into that. When I first made the transition to consulting, I had just come off of 5 years as an armor officer, and you end up with a certain style that way. I didn't realize that some of that style was still coming through, and some people could see it as intimidating. And the first time somebody told me, like, hey, Mike, some people find you, you know, I got some feedback. I was like, hey, some people find you a little bit intimidating. I'm like, why? And they're like, okay, you're 6'2". You used to drive around in a vehicle that weighed 68 tons and killed people. And you're really direct. I was like, okay, got it. You know, and it's just like, so I maybe need to kind of temper some of this. And I did learn the things. I had a great conversation with that person to say, all right, what are the things? And I said, well, you're physically imposing. So when you're standing up and talking to somebody, it's a really different conversation. If somebody's 5'2", 5'4", 5'6", even if they're 5'10" and you're looking down. So I'd start sitting down more in meetings, and I'd actually be seated in the room before other people walked in. So I didn't have that physical barrier. I then would sit back more in the meetings and just sort of take things in and offer opinions less frequently. I still knew what I wanted them to do, but I'd be really deliberate about, okay, is this a time to chime in or not? And just being willing to play with different styles and adapt things, because you can demonstrate executive presence without saying very much at all. And it's a lot of it can be in the body language. A lot of it can be in the way you rephrase questions or you rephrase points back to people. And it's really just the confidence of, I understand the situation. I got this. I'm comfortable here. Nobody stress out. Everybody's freaking out. Just everybody relax. It's going to be fine. And when you can exude that calm, that's actually more important than having some, you know, booming voice or presence that fills the room. The presence comes from, wow, this person is really calm and I think I want to follow them, because everybody else is freaking out, but that person seems to have their stuff together. Let's go in that direction.
I love a couple things about that. First of all, I appreciate how when this person gave you feedback, which might have been hard to receive, I can imagine a lot of people would either be triggered and argumentative around it or dismissive of, like, you don't know what you're talking about. But I love the curiosity that allowed you to drill down into specific things that were leading to people being intimidated by you. And then your willingness to play and experiment with those, of sitting down, knowing the direction, but chiming in less frequently, like really figuring out what would allow you to modify that. Rather than, I think at different points in my life, I would have just been like, no, I'm not intimidating. That's it. And move on. And so I love that openness.
Yeah. I I was very lucky. That was at McKinsey, and the culture there was very much one of fact-based feedback and observational feedback. There was an expectation that, hey, when you get feedback, it's serious and you need to listen. And then on top of that, we're going to give you the tools and resources to act on that feedback. It's not like it was sort of a drive-by, like, hey, you're intimidating, and they walk away. It was like, okay, let me explain a behavior. Have you ever seen yourself demonstrate this behavior? Okay, here's how other people can perceive it. Do you understand that perception? And they would walk you through the whole process. So I really learned how to give and receive feedback when I was at McKinsey, and Capital One also had a great culture around that stuff. Mm. But you know, it also comes down to trusting the other person and their intent when they're giving that feedback. And sometimes the openness, you know, they hit on a point and you're like, yeah, you nailed me. So, the woman who gave me the feedback said, you know, Mike, you're coming across as really military a lot of times. And I was like, what makes you say that? And she says, look at your clothes. And I looked down, I had on a green shirt and tan pants. I was like, got it, you know? And it was like, I looked at my wardrobe. It was like, oh my God, I basically have on, you know, my fatigues in corporate style. So, it was, you know, it's things like that. It sort of hit me between the eyes. And when it does, then saying, all right, I want to get better at this stuff. Let's play with my style. Let's play with different situations and how it plays out.
That's great. I also love what you said earlier about the calmness being one of these hallmarks of executive presence. And before you said that, I would have probably called out the other things that you mentioned, the booming voice, stature, maybe physical power and presence as executive presence. But what I'm loving is this sense of almost, I get this picture of like the lion that's relaxed. It doesn't need to make a show. It doesn't need to act defensive. It knows that it has the ability to execute. It knows it has the skills and everything it needs. And it's this calm, regal beast. And that's the image I got when you said that, of the calmness, which was surprising to me.
Yeah, I really saw that demonstrated with one guy, Steve. He was a very senior partner at McKinsey when I was there. We had an offsite. We were doing some M&A work with a client, and we had the entire C-suite in the room for an entire day. So it was the entire senior leadership team from the client, and it was our team, and Steve was there. And Steve would, you know, only come to certain events for the client when they were like really big events, just because he was serving so many clients. And Steve sat there all day in the back of the room. We were just sort of in a horseshoe shaped set of tables, looking at the screen and looking at the numbers and talking through the situation. And Steve's just sitting there in the back of the room, just sort of nodding. And he'd look at somebody and just really listen intently as they were speaking. And he may ask like one little clarifying question here and there. But most of the day, he was just sort of listening. But you saw he was there. I mean, he was dialed into everything everyone said. And then I remember in the afternoon, it was like 2 o'clock. And we started this meeting at about 8 a.m. About 2 o'clock, Steve leans back. He says, okay, so here's what I'm hearing. And it was like really measured the way he said that. The room was stone silent and everybody hung on that dude's every word. And it wasn't just because it was super insightful. It's because he was really measured and thoughtful and knew what he wanted to say and knew what his point was. And everybody walked out and after the meeting like, oh my God, Steve was so brilliant today. And when you heard people talking about him, you would have thought he led the whole offsite, mm-hmm. right? But he brought up like 3 or 4 points over the course of the day. But he was that confident in himself. He was that dialed into the other participants and really cared about the outcome. It was really neat to see him do that.
What I like about that when I hear that is this sense of mastery. Like I see that this person had mastered executive presence. And the reason why that's encouraging for me is I think of listeners, whether they've spent 3 years in the military or 20 years, in many ways, they've built up career capital around leadership, around command or executive presence. Like they've built these skills up and there's probably some polishing that needs to be done to many of the facets of that. And there's probably some missing components. But to realize that if this is mastery we're talking about, that's a lifelong pursuit. And a lot of the effort and ability that listeners have cultivated can
can build into that mastery, provided they can adapt and take the feedback that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd also encourage them to look at different models of how presence shows up. And I'm not talking about reading, I'm talking about go into a room and just shut up and watch the other people in the room and really get dialed into who does everybody listen to, and then watch what it is about that person, the way they conduct themselves. And you're gonna see, you're not gonna see any patterns at first at all. You're gonna see the person who is a little bit high energy and high strung and everybody listens to them. The next meeting, you're gonna see a person who's more like Steve and is super quiet. But there are so many different styles that can demonstrate that executive presence. And what I'll encourage listeners to do is find different models and try some of those on. Try being that person who only says three or four things the entire meeting. Granted, you better not be leading the meeting, but be that person who's just going to sit back and go, wow, I'm going to take it all in and I'm going to try and just offer a couple of really insightful points. And it may not work for you. You may go, yeah, that's so uncomfortable and I wasn't effective at it, but watch other styles for how people are showing up and who owns that room. And you may be surprised if you take off that traditional lens of I'm looking for the person with military bearing and command presence. It's like you're going to find some of those people, and that's great, but you're going to miss a lot of other styles that are available to you.
I love this aspect of experimentation as well, because I think in many of the interviews I've done, it seems like alignment is really important to veterans. Like they want to negotiate or network or sell in a way that feels good to them and authentic. And so what I'm hearing there is that you can observe, you can become a student and see these different models, experiment in low risk ways, and then figure out which ones work for you. Maybe some of them are great tactics and it just falls flat when you try it. And many of them, I'm guessing, are going to be a stretch. Like for many people, it would be difficult to sit in a meeting and not chime in every time they had a thought. But what a great way to practice this, if to sit back and say, I'm going to only say three things, and to really make those thoughtful and see if that lands, see if they get more of a response that way. I love that experimentation thought.
Yeah, you know, it's this openness to new styles, because I think we have our constructs of, these are the people I would follow, they're the ones that motivate me, therefore I will behave like that. And then when I see that behavior, then, you know, I'm going to be motivated and other people are going to be motivated if I do the same thing. I got a lesson in that a couple times. One time was I brought on a new instructor onto my team, and it was his first time teaching for me. He had taught previously and, you know, had a great career as well. And I said, all right, well, I'm going to sit in and I'm going to watch you teach. And he was teaching my content, my material. And he taught, and I sat in the back of the room for 8 hours, just watching and going, I don't know that I would have done it. Maybe I would have done it a little differently. I definitely wouldn't have said that. I wouldn't have explained it this way. And the whole day, I'm just looking at all these things that he was doing that I wouldn't have done it that way. And gee, I would have done it differently. And that was sort of the lens I had on all day. And he was doing fine. He was doing, you know, good job. But it was like, there are a lot of things I would suggest changing. Then I got the feedback forms at the end of class and I added them up. And in some areas, his scores were better than mine. And I had been doing this stuff for like, I don't know, 8 years. And I'm like, wait a minute, what? And it was just like, okay, I need to hit the rewind button right now, because are there things I'm doing that aren't as effective as I think they are? Or are there things that he's doing that I want to try on? And I never would have thought that that would have worked, but clearly based on the participant feedback on our feedback forms, it resonated. And there are some things I've picked up from him and some things it's like, yeah, that's his style. He's going to do that. I'm never going to do that. It's just not going to fit. But you know, constantly be learning. It's that learning mindset. You can always learn something from every interaction with someone, whether it's, yeah, I want to do what they did, or I'm never going to do what they did, but at least be open to learning in that moment.
Mm-hmm. I think that learning mindset is so crucial and in every capacity. But I also, when you're saying that, I'm aware for the first time of how perhaps limited our exposure is in the military to leadership styles. And I don't think I would have picked up on that prior to what you're saying, but I'm would at least throw it out for consideration for listeners to consider that the examples of leadership and management that you had in the military, while exceptional, are very likely a limited palette of skills and a limited palette of tools that people employ. And what I love about what you're highlighting here is to keep your ears open and your eyes peeled to learn and see a lot of different capacities of leadership and leadership that might not have worked in the military, but in a corporate setting, there's so many nuances, there's so many distinctions in leadership, and to be open to observing them, trying them, and making your own assessment of whether or not that's something you want to have in your wheelhouse to employ.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've seen, you know, if you want to use a golf analogy, right, it's like you think you're walking around with a bag full of clubs when you're in the service, and then you get out and you realize, oh, I only had a driver and a putter, and there's all these other tools that are available to me, and wow, what's this sand wedge? Let me try that thing next time, right? And you just pick up all these different clubs along the way, but you got to be willing to watch somebody else and see what they're doing and why they're doing it. Also, approach them afterwards and say, hey, you did this in this meeting and it worked really well. And they may tell you, oh yeah, here's a technique that I've used for like the last 15 years. You're like, oh my gosh, it's brilliant. You know, a lot of people will share those little tips and techniques with you. Sometimes they may not realize it. They may go, oh wow, yeah, I guess I just do that naturally. And, you know, it's a really nice compliment when somebody notices something you do well, but a lot of times there's really deliberate stuff that people are doing in terms of how they're carrying themselves, how they're varying the tone of voice, facial expressions, gestures, where they sit in the room, who they sit next to. You know, all of it is really well thought out, much more thought out than you might initially think.
Hmm. Any other tips? I know you're giving us a gold mine of information here, but any other tips you want to highlight for people of practicing and improving their executive presence?
I'd say put yourself in uncomfortable situations, because where presence really shines through is not when everybody loves the idea and you're in the meeting and you're leading the idea that everybody loves. That's easy. Where presence shows up is when a client loses it in the meeting and starts going ballistic on whatever element of your idea is, and your ability to stay composed in that moment and remain thoughtful and try a different technique, right? So to do that, you got to put yourself in some uncomfortable situations to feel what those muscles feel like, to feel like if a trigger is going off for you and like, hey, I'm getting amped up. And, you know, for me, one of the things I always got feedback on is my eyes. My eyes are really expressive. And when people would start, you know, frustrating me or something, all of a sudden my eyes would pop open really wide. And people are like, dude, that is terrifying when you do that. And it's great because I have kids, so that works. But, you know, in meetings, I would do that. And I go, wow, there's this thing that I do. And I got to understand that I have those tendencies. And then to be able to temper it and then be more mindful of, I'm going into a meeting where people might upset me and I need to just breathe and sit back. But I had to put myself in those uncomfortable situations to build those muscles to be able to keep my eyes from flying out of my head, you know, when I would get upset about something. So I encourage listeners, like, try putting yourself in some difficult spots and do it deliberately. Know what you're trying to learn and what new muscles you're trying to build in those situations.
I love that. I'm a big fan of discomfort and the things that we can learn when we're willing to take those risks. I also just want to call out for listeners, if any of you are finding this, if it seems like acting, my view on it is a little bit different, which is there's ways that we all habitually act where we're not aware of the impact that is having on someone. I in one of my men's groups was talking about a conversation I had with my wife where in my mind I was extremely calm and composed and she was being unreasonable. And one of the guys was like, man, is that how you said that? Because that there is so much energy behind what you're saying and I would be intimidated by the way you're saying that. And I had no clue. And so what I love about what you're saying, Mike, is it's kind of bringing awareness to the way that we show up that might be having an impact that is the exact opposite of what we want to have. And just bringing awareness there and choosing to show up differently to have the desired outcome. So I hope this doesn't come across to people as disingenuous or being different than you are. It's more just realizing like, man, this is coming out sideways. This is, you know, this is scaring people. I don't want to scare people. This is exciting people when I want them to be calm. It's just realizing that sometimes we have the opposite impact that we desire to have.
Yeah, that's, I think that's spot on and very well said. You know, it's not acting. It's the awareness of the moment and the awareness of how you might react. A lot of times when I'm coaching executives on executive presence, I get them looking at their schedule for the week ahead and saying, what meetings do you have coming up where you're going to lose it, where you're going to get frustrated, you're going to get upset, you're going to be off balance. And let's talk about those meetings. Let's talk about what are those triggers going to be and what is the other reaction you're going to call on in that moment. So if you would normally, you know, lean forward or go up to the whiteboard, let's try doing the opposite. And I want you to lean back and ask a question instead of offering a perspective. But by understanding ahead of time, hey, I'm going to go in a meeting with Joe and Joe always makes me nuts, I can be better prepared for that situation, right? You know, I mean, you think about the military, it's not like you'd ever hit the battlefield and just go, oh, I have no idea what's coming. I mean, think about all the planning that goes on before you go out there to understand what the possible situations might arise and what your appropriate reaction is going to be in that moment. It's just a different battlefield, right? And it's like, okay, I'm going to a meeting with these 10 people and it's our project team and they all make me nuts. Okay, well, okay, what are the 10 things they're going to say that'll make you crazy? And what are the 10 countermeasures to that? And then more importantly, are there things you can do before the meeting or as you go into the meeting to even prevent those triggers from happening? Right? So it's really understanding the environment you're going to operate in and trying to shape it in a way that's more productive, that's going to eliminate counterproductive behaviors on your part and really have your intent followed through.
And I hope two of the threads that are coming through for listeners really strongly here is one, a extreme willingness to experiment playfully with little fear of failure, just trying things out and seeing what sticks. And then the overriding sense of preparation and how when, especially the executives that Mike's talking about here who are operating at such a high level and to realize that, you know, everything they're doing is deliberate. They are sitting in certain spots, they're saying certain things, they're sitting back, like they're very invested in the outcome. And because of that, they're, you know, at 100%, they are present, they're paying attention, they're thoughtful, they're deliberate. And it makes me aware of how often I just kind of roll in haphazardly. It's great to see at this, at that level, what we can aspire to be through that planning. And I love the analogy you make to in the military. It's the exact same principles, just applied in a very different way in a different setting.
Yeah. Well, and the other nice thing is, okay, go ahead and take risks because guess what? Nobody's going to die on the procurement study. You know, it's like in the military, you take a risk. Yeah, there's some pretty nasty consequences that could come along with that. But it's like, well, in this meeting that, you know, we're rolling out the new vendor negotiation strategy, I'm going to sit back and just try to not talk as much. Okay. Like what's the worst outcome that can possibly happen? You know, it's the risk profile of the environment where you're trying these new things on. It may feel terrifying. And you know what? It'll also feel familiar. Because adrenaline doesn't differentiate. The amygdala doesn't differentiate. The amygdala just goes threat and it just gets you amped up. And it doesn't differentiate between, you know, an enemy tank or an IED or, you know, Joe from procurement who makes funny faces at you when you say stuff. Mm-hmm. It doesn't differentiate. So your ability to sort of tame that response and know that you might have that response in a meeting and then be able to deal with that response more productively in the moment is something that's well worth investing in.
You've already cited a couple of examples, but I'm wondering if there's any other examples that stand out to you for either of strong or weak executive presence and how that helped or hurt any of your clients.
You know, I think the weak presence shows up in not being intentional about what you're saying or in understanding the audience and where they are and where you want to move them. A lot of times what I'll see is nerves will show up in the form of more pressured speech. I start talking quicker. I got to get something out, and the mouth will just become, and the mouth just keeps going and going and going and going. And that's where presence breaks down. We feel like we have to fill the air. A pause every once in a while can let people know I'm being more thoughtful here. I'm being more deliberate. I'm nice and calm. I know what I'm trying to get across. Those pauses eliminate the verbal pauses of and you know. So those are triggers of stress or signs of stress. Being willing to just slow down is really what that differentiator can be. So the people who don't demonstrate presence are the ones who are letting those nerves get the best of them. Just take a breath. Take a breath. And it's okay if somebody asks you a question that you didn't see coming. To just say, people feel like, oh, this executive asked me this question and I have to answer right now. It's totally acceptable. And actually, I highly encourage it to say, you know, that's really interesting. I had not thought of that before. Let me just take a minute to think about that and get you an answer. If you guys want to keep talking, go ahead. But I just really want to think about this and be thoughtful in my response. And most people will go, okay, cool. It, you know, it's amazing to just insert that pause. We don't feel like we have the permission to do it. And the people who won't do it are the ones where you say, yeah, that person, they don't really have presence. They're pretty flustered pretty easily. I mean, to sit there and say to like a CEO or you're, you know, an SVP, like, yeah, that's a great question. I hadn't thought of that before. Let me be thoughtful about this. Let me put some time to that. They're like, man, that dude is comfortable. To be able to tell somebody like that to wait, they want the best answer. They don't want you to just start spouting off without thinking about it.
I mean, I can only imagine if someone said that to me, the impact would be more respect for them. It's like, I feel valued. I feel like they're not just on autopilot. They're not just in sales mode. They're actually taking time to craft this unique answer for me. I think that would come across to most people really well.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the power of the pause and the power of being able to say, I need to think, is incredible. Just try it once. Try in a low risk meeting with like your boss or a stakeholder you work with a lot and let them ask you a question. And even if you know the answer, even if the answer is like on the tip of your tongue, go ahead and say, hey, can I just pause for a minute? Let me think about that. Now, don't do it with something like totally obvious and they're like, why don't you know this, right? But something where, you know, it would require a little bit more of a cerebral response, try that out and just see how it goes. And they're going to go, okay, yeah, go ahead, take a minute, think about that. That'd be great. Because they want to get to the best answer. It's not the speed round on Family Feud, you know?
I also always love to ask about resources, and I particularly think of our show notes at beyondtheuniform.org. I'll have a list of the books that Mike's written, but also the resources that you recommend. What would you recommend in terms of books, podcasts, conferences, websites, anything that might help listeners they could get their hands on in the next couple of weeks to delve deeper into this?
Yeah, so obviously books are great. You know, my instructors on my team have written a lot of great books. A few of them that I will point to, one is called Getting Ahead by Joel Garfinkel. And that one talks about perception, visibility, and influence. So how are you perceived? And by the way, every strength has a negative side to it. So how are you perceived? How do you build visibility in the organization in a positive way? And therefore, how do you demonstrate influence? So that book's great. And we teach a course based on that stuff. I love Joel's work. And Joel's blog talks about a lot of these issues as well. The folks over at the Leadership Podcast, Jan Rutherford and Jim Vassilopoulos, who I know you probably know those guys really well, and your listeners may too. They host awesome guests on the podcast. Right now, they're going through a series of talking to a lot of the folks on my team, which I can't wait to hear those lessons. They do some really nice stuff. Another one, when I talk about this ability to breathe and pause and get the amygdala to chill out and sort of put the mental alarm on pause, one of my folks, John John Wortman wrote a book called Hijacked by Your Brain. And it talks all about this stress response and how when something bad happens, all of a sudden we start freaking out and we lose control in that moment. And when we go to what he calls the short loop, which is that stimulus response. And it's how do you create that long loop where it's stimulus. Okay, let me think about this. Let me formulate a response and then more appropriate response. So the book is does a really nice job of laying out that approach. So those are a few that I'd suggest right off the bat.
That's great. And for listeners, I'll have links to all of those in the show notes, as well as I'll link to Jan's one of the few people we've had twice on the podcast. And I'll link to both of the interviews that he did for Beyond the Uniform. One question that just kind of occurs to me here is about online presence. And you strike me as someone who's done a really incredible job of cultivating through LinkedIn and other channels your online presence. Do you have either any advice on how listeners can cultivate their online presence, or how online presence relates to this executive presence?
So online presence, I'm trying to teach my kids some of these lessons. They're in their early 20s. And, every interaction people have with you forms part of your brand. And I am really thoughtful about, when I post something on Twitter or on Facebook or on LinkedIn, it's like, okay, everything I do is tied to my business, right? So I'm a little bit more meticulous about this than a lot of other professionals are, because every single touch point you run into me out in the world, whether it's a podcast or a blog post or a tweet, hopefully I'm getting you interested in the work that we do. And therefore you come to the website and the blog and you check that out. And then maybe you bring us in for that type of work. But that doesn't mean I don't have fun too, because if you're in one of our classrooms, when I teach, it's like an 8-hour comedy routine with a little bit of content interspersed. So when you read my blog posts, they're fun. When you listen to my podcasts, I joke around from time to time. I understand what the brand is, and this goes a lot to the work that Joel does around perception, visibility, and influence. So I think you've got to look at it and say, there are people who have never met you, and what kind of picture are they going to put together if they stitch together your last 50 tweets, your last 20 Facebook posts, the 50 things that you liked on LinkedIn, and your latest blog post? How would they describe you, right? And is that a description you're going to be happy with, or one where you're going to go, ooh, yeah, I'm not really, yeah, I see it. So I am deliberate and thoughtful about what I put out there. It doesn't mean it's not me. It's always authentically me. But it's kind of funny. I did a webcast for a group of folks who had read my first book as part of a college program. It was like an executive ed program, and that's all they knew of me was they read the first book, and then I think they may have read a couple of blogs, and some folks may have done a little bit of research. And I got on to the webinar and spoke for about an hour with them, just doing Q&A. And at the end, they were like, man, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. I'm like, dude, what made you think this was not going to be fun? And then I'm like, wait a minute. The only exposure they've had to me is the written word without a voice, without video, right? And there's not a lot of jokes in the book. There's some funny stuff. But it's like, yeah, people are going to start forming that perception. So when you're putting stuff out there, I encourage people to say, is this consistent with the brand that I'm trying to build, how I want people to experience me? And if it's not, you may want to think about it, right? Things that you like and share. I hate Facebook because, just the stuff that people share on there, you're like, dude, do you understand, just by you having that in your feed, by proxy, you are that. And people aren't that thoughtful about it. That's why you go on my Facebook feed, it's like mostly like dog videos. They're kind of funny because it's like Army football and Cleveland Indians and the Cleveland Browns, right? And it's like that's where that personal side of me shows up. So just be thoughtful about it. The other thing I encourage people to do is give, right? And if you want to get your message out there, don't sell. Just put your perspectives out there and people will find you. And even if you're not selling and you're not running a business, you're still selling. You're selling yourself to that next employer. You're selling yourself for that next role internally. You're selling yourself for that next project that's going to come your way. So put your perspectives out there. Don't necessarily look to monetize everything or think that it's, you know, you're putting a sales pitch out. I mean, I do tons and tons of podcasts like this and webinars and write my blog posts, and the blog is free. And, you know, it's like, all right, somebody's going to bump into it and go, hey, this stuff's kind of cool. Maybe I should talk to this guy. Right. And you never know where that next opportunity is going to come from, but be generous with your thoughts, be generous with your perspectives, with your tools, refer other people, create opportunities for them. Cause then it comes around, right? Then it comes around, but do it because it's the right thing. Do it because you're altruistic. And if nobody says thank you and nothing ever comes of it, all right, well, you still did a nice thing and created an opportunity for somebody. So enjoy that. Feel good about that.
That's awesome. Well, I always like to leave space at the end, which is we've covered a lot of ground. I think you've given tremendous amount of quality information for listeners. I'm sure there's things I didn't ask about that you have thoughts about, or I just want to make space for either what have we not covered that you want listeners to know before we wrap up, or what's one piece of advice you'd like to leave them with?
I mean, we could go on for hours just talking about things that I find entertaining and interesting and fun. So we won't consume the time with that. I think the one thing, and we've already talked about it, but I just really want to emphasize the point, and it's try on new things, try on new skills, put yourself in uncomfortable and challenging situations, because that is the only way you are going to grow. The only way you're going to add tools to your toolkit. You know, be uncomfortable, be inquisitive, ask people. You're going to be shocked at how deliberate and intentional a lot of people are about a lot of the things they do. And those little tools, I've picked them up over the years, whether it's little phrases that I use or physical cues. And it's funny. So two execs that I was coaching, one was a division president, one was a director in that division president's organization. And they both knew I was coaching the other. And one meeting, the director went in for his one-on-one with the division president, and he was explaining some situation, and the division president leans back and he looks at him and he says, "Say more." And the director looks at him and he goes, "Oh my God, are you going to pull a Figliolo on me?" Because the phrase "say more" is something that I coach people on, and it's a way to get people to open up and share things. And it was just so funny that they both keyed in on that phrase and that Sean used it on Matt. But, you know, they learned it. They learned those things. And I learned that from somebody I can't remember who taught me. But those little tools are incredibly powerful. The only way you fill that toolkit is by understanding who's using those tools and how are they using them along the way.
Hmm. Well, I love it. I love the advice. And I appreciate your sharing this with the Beyond the Inform audience. I'll have a ton of videos and books in the show notes for listeners. Mike produces a lot of content and a lot of it's available for free. And so I encourage you to check that out. But Mike, thanks for your generosity of time today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. And every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free-flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all-volunteer
army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team, she writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org, there is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly, and the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.